Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
In light of the events of the last 12 months, perhaps I have more to reflect on than most.
The royal family is in genuine crisis.
Have royal scandals damaged the country's reputation?
The House of Windsor should be binding the nation together, setting an example of idealized family life. It's a situation that cannot help but affect the stability of the country.
For years, I've called for a more modern monarchy that reflects the world outside.
I don't think it's my behavior that's threatening its survival.
You, as future king, have a duty.
People will never understand how it's really been for me. I never stood a chance.
She's at breaking point because of the way she feels she's been treated. They see her as a threat.
Remember the one condition, the one rule. You remain loyal to this family.
Who is silent?
Yes, it's a system. For better or for worse, we're all stuck in it.
It feels it's all about to erupt.
She opens her mouth and hand grenades come out. She wants to tear down the temple.
Let's go for it.
What the hell is she doing?
I won't go quietly. I'll battle till the end.
Our glories belong to the past. Then the world will move on. And we'll be left with nothing.
How did it come to this?
So we'll find out now what Richard Fitzwilliams really makes of that work of fiction, that ridiculous, overemphasized hyperbole that we're being faced with night after night. You can even watch it on a whole connection of that sort of side of things. I mean, clearly, we need to actually ensure that the jungle trials of the awesomely wonderful Matt Hancock needs to be put firmly in its place as just horrendous fiction and just completely at odds with the legitimacy of the work of obviously Peter Morgan in The Crown. I mean, I presume, Richard, that's the key thing. You're more concerned really with respect to what the public will make of our members of Parliament than what they'll actually sort of do with in terms of the accuracy of obviously the latest incarnation, Series 5, in which Elizabeth Debicki takes on board the mantle of Princess Diana, and indeed, I believe Timothy West's child actually takes on board the line of being Prince Charles, or maybe not.
It's Dominic West. Yes.
Dominic West, exactly. Yes.
What the problem with The Crown? Firstly, let's be clear, it's dramatized fiction based on actual events or inspired by them, or what to say. It's also moved its fifth season, just to remind listeners, now 50, and there are going to be 60. It goes up to 2005, which will climactically will depict the marriage of Charles and Camilla. I do not think that they will be very sanguine, given the particular thrust of The Crown and its message. I'm according to Peter Morgan, and he's a dab hand at this sort of thing. There's no real excuse other than an intense dislike of the monarchy to push things in the way that he has, and with a script and also the choice of characters. Because we saw The Queen with Helen Mirren, again, the very, very successful. We saw the audience about the Queen's relationship with her prime ministers, or some of them on stage, and we've seen the deal and Frost Nixon. But what the problem that characterizes The Crown is an agenda that was not clear, although there were examples of it in the first two seasons. I had somewhat of a Faustian pact with it. what essentially it shows the royals is as untrustworthy, nasty, snobbish, very, very vulpine and inquisitive. And the difficulty with this, firstly, I mean, you can have a view whether they are or whether they're not, but you're dramatizing and depicting a lot of people now who are alive, and they have had a lot to say about it, Sir John Major, Sir Tony Blair, about the fact that a lot of it's rubbish. The problem is that it's worldwide, it's well known. We know that at one point, I think it was over 70 million had seen it and so forth, and a large number of people watching will not be aware that this is fictional. They'll think it happened. It will certainly plant ideas into their head that it might have, but I mean, there's a scene, just to give one example, Diana's car brakes fail. Now, they never did. She was somewhat paranoid on this, and this is another issue, security issues, and thought they might. They do. Well, they didn't. But is he, Peter Morgan, trying to fuel conspiracy theories by showing it? Because people will very likely think that they might have. It's that, that is just one example, and there are many. You could begin with Sir John Major being told, because of a poll has been somewhat twisted, by Charles, that the Queen should abdicate, be persuaded to abdicate. Climactically, at the end of this fifth season, we have him doing exactly the same thing to Tony Blair. Neither scene happened. Yes, there's some fine acting. Yes, the production values are remarkable. But what you need to do is to ask yourself, the dead can't sue. The palace, obviously, the royals won't. To ethically, it's one thing to believe that monarchy is insane and compare it to a mutating virus, as Peter Morgan has. Then, on the other hand, he said that this is his love letter to the Queen. It's got very poisoned edges because a lot of what we see didn't happen, and a lot of it has a very nasty twist to it.
Well, I think you certainly have sat on the fence there, Richard, and haven't really sort of made your particular views known. Let's turn to Jessica Burtis as an American living in Dublin. And we know how passionate the Dublin citizens can be over the royal family. Let's not go there. Jessica, have you seen any episodes of The Crown? Is it something that appeals to you? Or is it something which you tend to think, I just don't know. Maybe Hilary Mantel is absolutely right. That, as the late Hilary Mantel actually said, we'll have a King William, but after that, it'll be basically put to bed, as it should have been perhaps many years ago.
I really enjoy shows like The Crown. I like a lot of historical pieces, and this one's interesting because the characters in it are, for the most part, alive or have been in recent years. I think that the British monarchy especially is always, like, they have some of the most interesting shows. I really liked Victoria. I think that's also another excellent show. With The Crown, I feel like it does change things, kind of like how Richard was saying, since the people alive, they can actually watch themselves on screen and they can have opinions about how their own life is being portrayed. I can't imagine what that's like. I know that a lot of the royal family grows up in kind of the spotlight, but to still see yourself on screen, that must be a little bizarre, especially if you disagree with it. I haven't watched into the more recent seasons, but I know they're very controversial. You know, once Diana shows up, it becomes something that a lot of people had a lot of strong opinions about, even in the US while that was happening, and still have strong opinions about, honestly. And I feel like with the Queen's passing, that's kind of brought a lot of those emotions back for a lot of people. And I want to see if anybody else from the US who watches The Crown kind of feels the same way, because I know a lot of people watch it. And also, I think the portrayals are just done very well, at least from what I've seen. And I have to say, like, the costumes are just beautiful. I always love costumes in historical pieces. And I feel like this show does costumes so well. And the sets are beautiful. And I feel like that has, like, a big draw for me. If it's very pretty, I'll be interested.
There we are, you see, very pretty. And indeed, coming up next, we'll be speaking to a fabulous soul who is actually responsible for doing her own version of the blue of the Buckingham Palace Gardens in the same way she once made Tracy Island for Thunderbirds. Yes, Anthea Turner is joining us on the programme.
Clearly, when you're looking at the cost of living crisis and sustainability and a whole variety of other bits and pieces, you need to actually seek major input and advice from somebody who's a trusted source, somebody who's a guaranteed source of information, somebody who I think the phrase Renaissance woman can duly be applied. Yes, I'm referring to Stoke's finest, of course, probably the best presenter Blue Peter ever had. And I know we've worked regularly with Janet Ellis, but I still say Anthea Turner is tops. Anthea, welcome to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
Oh, Alex, could you just speak to me every day and make me feel good about myself? Do you know what? I saw Janet Ellis only last night, because Blue Peter presenters do actually stick together. We are genuinely friends. And I'm seeing Diane Louise Jordan tomorrow and John Leslie when he gets back from his holidays just before Christmas. So there we go. We're all together.
There you go. Clearly, I have to go for the dream team of yourself and Janice on the same show, which would be sort of ideal.
Oh, dear, Alex, we need to make that happen for you.
Exactly. Okay, let's move on to this particular research, which I found was quite fascinating. It comes from cleaning and laundry expert Dr. Beckman, and 53% of the nation are looking for affordable solutions to maintain their homes. Now, you've got five top household hacks that I know you're going to share with us, Anthea. But first of all, were you surprised by this research, or did you think, yeah, it's a tough time out there?
Well, I probably wasn't surprised. It confirmed what I suspected, but also they are my genuine feelings as well. I think, and I don't know about you, well, I'll ask you the question. If there was a major appliance in your home that went wrong and you would go, oh my goodness me, this is a catastrophe. How long is it going to get me? You know, can I get a replacement? Can I get them mended? What's going to happen? Which would it be?
Yes, that's a tough one, actually, from that perspective, because clearly you've got, I mean, yeah, you're probably going to say it's going to be either a washing machine or a cooker or something. It's going to be a white good, shall we say, somewhere, one of the white goods.
The research came out with most people were fretting about a washing machine. Lots of other things you think, oh, if the cooker goes wrong, I've got the microwave and I can sort of get away with that for a little while. You know, I can wash up in the old fashioned way. I can mop floors a bit, I can brush up. But really, the washing machine for a household, it's a big ticket item. You don't get much change out of, you know, it's sort of £350 to £500 now for a good washing machine. This is the thing where it's started to go a little bit wrong. People are not looking after them. And you know that old thing that maybe you and I do inherently know, because we are of a generation that would know this. You know, you look after your stuff and it will look after you. And things don't just sort of magically keep going for years and years and years unless you maintain them. And my question really to anybody who's listening is this. When did you last clean your washing machine? And most importantly, when did you last clean your drum? And I've had lots of answers to this. Go on, Alex, tell me when you last cleaned your drum.
Do you know, I have to say, probably a long, long time ago. So it's almost like having a confession here. Basically, bless me, Anthea, it has been many months since I actually did my cleaned the washing drum. So yeah, let's not go there.
Well, I know what you're going to be doing tonight, Alex. You're going to be cleaning your drum, because this will most definitely prolong the life of your washing machine. Now, my last washing machine died. She did. I was very attached to her. She was 26. She had worked really, really hard.
For a washing machine, that's a significant lifetime.
Exactly. But I want my new washing machine to last the same amount of time. And there's no reason why it shouldn't if I look after it. There's a vogue at the moment, of course, for environmental reasons and cost reasons, is that we take it, you know, a 30 degree wash. Oh, really? No, well, we could go down to 20. Yeah, that's absolutely fine. But at least once every 2 months, you should do you do a 60 degree wash once every 2 months, and that cleans everything through. You need to put some product in to improve that as well. And Dr. Beckman, which was why they did this survey, they do something called Service It, which is a deep clean for your washer. And you think all these products, you know, they're no more than about £3. And even a 60 degree wash. And we did, because I asked the question, I said, well, you know, people are worried about 60 degree washes because it costs so much money. And we did some sums, and generally on an average for an hour, which is you have to do it for an hour, it's about 24 pence. So really, if you consider that your washer cart is going to replace your washer is going to be £450 or thereabouts, it's not a lot really, is it, to think about, to prolong that life of your washer. So, and you can use this in so many other areas of your home, can't you?
Clearly, it makes sense. So this is why we need a virtual Anthea Turner it popping up on every computer screen across the planet to actually work.
Have you cleaned your drum?
Exactly. This is it. It's sort of accusatory, but in a friendly manner, which is fantastic.
Of course it is. But you know, sometimes, and I know that people have been listening thinking, oh, you know, do I really have to do this? The seal, there are various little areas of a washing machine that really need our time. And it doesn't take very long with a cloth. The seal on the washing machine, you don't want it to go, because if it goes, it costs money to get it repaired. And even then, sometimes it's never completely successful. You know, if you pull the drawer out where you put all your products and you peer into that chasm of a drawer, you'll see it. It doesn't look very nice. And you sort of get a cloth in and you try and clean it, but you can never completely get around all those little bobbles,
nooks and crannies.
Yes, there was a little whiz, and I peer inside. I've even got the torch on my camera on my phone and sort of, you know, just looked through it. Oh dear. That's what we can see. That's what you and I can see. But inside the washer, there's lots more of that. So if we clear the pipes, if we make sure, and if I'm in London, so it's a hard water area as well. So in a lot of these products, they've also got things that will help to get rid of the calcium, which all the deposits that are in it. Your washer will run perfectly. It'll be beautifully washing your clothes and spinning around and enjoying life with you, symbiotic life with you for some time to come.
Works perfectly. I mean, battling the line scale, lightening the laundry load, deep cleaning the appliances, which you've just shared. I can almost see producers out there thinking, we need another reality TV show. What about cleaning your washing machine with Anthea?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to do that as we sat there watching our washing machine go round with a nice glass of Pinot Noir in our hand, making sure we don't drop it on the carpet. But if you do drop it on the carpet, I know all the ways to get rid of that.
Essential. For folk who wish to find out more about Dr. Beckman's products and various other areas, where would you point them, Anthea?
Well, they have got, thank you for asking, they've got a great website, and it's dr-beckman.co.uk. So they have lots of products, obviously. Nothing's really very expensive. And I say, I've always liked them because they're very no-nonsense. And they also don't shy away from talking about white vinegar and soda crystals and things that we've all got around the house. So, you know, really good, sound advice. And in this day and age now, we just need to look after what we've got and make it last as long as it possibly can, a little bit like you and myself.
Well, I know we're born in the decade of the 60s, both of us, from that point of view, so we just progress ever onwards in that side of things. I might as well point out as well, Dr. Beckman, not to be confused with the villainous scientist in the Spy Who Loved Me episode of the James Bond film series, because different line entirely. They were cleaning different kind of washing machine. That's really important.
Think of that. Very good.
Anthea, it's been awesome connecting with your good self. We've got two questions we always put to our regular co-hosts and pro-presenters. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Have I? Well, I have, because I'm obviously looking at you, and behind you is the most beautiful scene.
What is that
scene, pray?
That would happen to be, for the benefit of the radio listener, because I always find Zoom works so well on the radio, yeah. A bit like tap dancing and ventriloquism, also good lines for that point of view. That would be the gardens at Buckingham Palace, actually, from the rear of the whole piece. So,
truly, truly beautiful is that.
Well, we felt we had broadcasting royalty. We needed to have a royalty-based backdrop, so that was critical.
Well, I did... there's a new series of The Crown coming out, and funnily enough, you might remember I made Tracy Island on Blue Peter, and Netflix pulled me out of crafting retirement and asked me if I could make Buckingham Palace, which I duly did.
So, and a superb job you have made of it.
I'm very proud of that. It's on my. If you go onto my Instagram, you can see it there.
Well, it brings us neatly around to the next question. Can we prevail upon you, Anthea, to join us again in the not-too-distant future? Will you come back to the Midweek Drive?
Of course, Alex. You are so charming. How could I stay away?
Anthea Turner. I'm sure it'll be Dame Anthea Turner. We need to start the campaign before too long. We need to progress on that. For the moment, huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
All right, then, Alex. Thank you so much.
Time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
Paul Bäumer.
Ich möchte noch nicht loslegen.
Wir sind jetzt an der Westfront.
Vous avez 72 heures pour accepter nos conditions.
Ich werde nicht kapitulieren.
Meine Mutter wollte nicht, dass ich in den Krieg ziehe. Ich wollte ihnen zeigen, dass ich das kann.
Ach, Paul. Ja, um nach Hause zu kommen.
Ich vermisse meine Kameraden weg!
Schließen wir Frieden.
Ich hab Angst vor dem, was kommt.
Du musst jetzt tapfer sein. Für die, die es nicht geschafft haben. Für uns alle.
Wie geht's? Es tut mir leid. Well, yes, it's for the first time, of course, All Quiet on the Western Front, featuring Germans and perhaps understandably a German story from their perspective, and a very heartrending story, which if anybody ever actually wished to actually say the glory of war, they certainly should actually be put to rights immediately. The original novel, of course, written back in 1929, the first movie that was made in Hollywood with American soldiers portraying Germans, very much won an Academy Award at the time. And Richard Fitzwilliams will take us through now in terms of his thoughts on the latest incarnation, which surely should actually be in the running for Best Foreign Language Picture at next year's Academy Awards. That's All Quiet on the Western Front. Richard.
Yes, Alexander. On Remembrance Sunday, it's only too relevant, I fear, to think back and think back also on what actually happened. This is a visceral film. It's directed by Edward Berg, as you say. It's based on Erich Remarque's classic novel. And also, of course, there was the famous film of some 90 years ago. This is, I mean, it uses CGI just so amazingly, but it really, really is a ferocious experience. I can only describe it as that. I mean, the realism, I mean, this is visceral. The scenes, it opens, you see fox cubs in a forest, the camera pans upwards, you see some trees, you move up, and then you look down what's beyond them, and you see the horrifying no man's land with corpses and mud, and I mean, the battlefields are extraordinarily recreated. We meet Paul Baumer, played by Felix Kammerer, a German soldier, as you say, it's a German film, who fights on the Western Front. He lives with his parents and sister in a German village. The students are all volunteering, and they all believe that this is a righteous cause. He becomes close to Kat, played by Albert Schutt, and there are several of them in this little group, and we follow them through experiences that I can only describe as terrifying. I mean, the conditions in the trenches, you see the warfare, the way it moves back and forth, but just a few yards. It's the use of gas, for example. There's a particularly horrifying section which deals with this. Initially, the soldiers are receiving uniforms that they don't know it from dead soldiers. And what you see at the beginning is the whole thing is this form of mechanized horror which become inhuman from the very start. And this is made so clear by the opening sequences where we see the uniforms being recycled, and then also as the war progresses, we meet Matthias Erzberger, played by Daniel Brühl, very well known German actor, who meets with the German High Command to persuade them to begin talks for an armistice because it's abundantly clear that they are losing. And then we cut to the soldiers, where Paul and Kat steal a goose from a local farm. This recurs, and indeed with unfortunate consequences. What you see is the most extraordinary battle sequences. I mean, there's one where a German advance is halted by tanks, by aircraft, and by flamethrowers. It's quite. I mean, that anyone, not to mention supposedly civilized nations, got involved in anything resembling this for as long as it did is almost beyond belief. It's a frightening view of the inhumanity of the conflict. And also, as I say, it never loses its sense of humanity because you've got an excellent performance by Felix Kammerer. You've got the absolutely bizarre circumstances of this. And you also have, and it's cleverly handled, the scenes which I don't remember from the first film, are linked to the armistice and also Germans who don't want to give up. And we know, of course, what the armistice and what subsequently happened at Versailles led to. And you get elements of this. It's superb, but it is very, very tough viewing.
Two things, Richard. I feel you mentioned that the Germans were losing. Actually, in war, everybody loses. And I think that point needs to be made quite clear, because clearly the message, even though the United Nations at the time, in fact, it was Variety magazine in Hollywood that actually had said that what would have been the best thing ever in 1930 was for the movie to be made available to every country in the League of Nations to be aware of the futility of war. And as we see in the Ukraine, humanity in many ways still isn't learning this lesson. The second point, I think that although I certainly would rate the Carl Laemmle 1930 movie as being superb in its own way, I feel also that its ending was slightly more poignant than the ending that we actually got here. We still have the same ending, but it's a different sort of aspect in terms of the ticking to armistice. Natasha, you've seen the 1930 version, of course. Any thoughts of yourself on that one, or indeed the latest Netflix incarnation?
So I haven't had a chance to watch the current incarnation. We've been having all sorts of things going off weather-wise today. So if the power suddenly goes, I might cut out. But no, I liked the original. I'm really glad that it's being done here by the sounds of it in German. I feel like that's really important to, you know, give a much more authentic portrayal to the audience. I'm sure that the CGI in it will be a lot more spectacular. I have seen a couple of clips from it floating around the last couple of days on the internet. I know it's being talked about a lot on there, and there's a lot of praise for it. The original, I imagine it's a very similar theme to the original. The original was very heavy. it's obviously the theme of it is, you know, when you're dealing with the futility of war, it's always going to be a heavy movie. I do really want to watch this one. heaven willing with the power, but I think it's going to be one that I'm really going to have to sit down and really be in the mood for it, because I feel like it's one of those movies that really deserves a lot of my attention and my full focus. And so I think I would have to be in the mindset to see it. I don't mind seeing things when they're, I don't mind seeing graphic scenes when there's a poignant, when there's a purpose to it. And I feel like a movie like this, there's much more purpose to it than, you know, sort of like in a slashing horror movie or something like that. So that probably wouldn't put me off. Yeah, it would just be sort of finding a time when my mood was accessible for me to fully appreciate what was going on, I think, in the movie. But I would very much like to see it, and especially because it's in German, which is exciting.
I think the sad thing is nobody should ever really be in the mood for a war movie, because it tends to translate war as entertainment, and that's another issue entirely. Cathy Mansour, you've been obviously to the Ukraine. You have reported obviously on the American Marines in past, etc. Obviously, the Americans, they clearly actually are mentioned in All Quiet on the Western Front, because clearly it was the arrival of the Americans that effectively turned the tide in a war which, as indeed is stated at the end of the movie, effectively, I think they managed to move in total about 100 yards over the 4 years, losing something like a quarter of a million lives and so on. So, Cathy, your thoughts on this one?
I mean, I think it's, there's a, whenever it comes with a war film, there's a really thin line. And what's like, unfortunately, what war films kind of go into is that it kind of glorifies or it becomes very patriotic in a certain sense that we've seen often. And I think war is a really simple term to describe what's actually happening, because you have 100 stories, thousands of stories happening when a war is going over. A lot of people, they see the word war and they understand conflict, but that's just a really simplification of what's going on, because just because one person is against another or one country is against another, it doesn't talk about all the human aspects that are happening in between, you know, like what happens when you cut off power to a nation, what happens when you stop their water flow, what happens to the people that live there, are they moving, or are they trying to stay? And that's and again, that's just scratching the surface of it. And I think that's the difficulty when you have these kind of war films, because they can only really give you an aspect of, you know, the soldiers, the military that's going in, which is an important factor, but there's thousands of other things going around in it. And I have seen the original a while ago, but, and I think they, when I watched it, I think it was just a very, I guess, honest experience is the best way I can say about that. But, and I do want to see the new, I have seen a few clips, and I think how it's filmed looks quite amazing. But I think it comes down to trying to keep in mind what else is going on in here that people aren't really considering, especially when it comes to modern conflict.
Many of the actors in the original Carl Laemmle movie, of course, had fought in the Great War, as they referred to it at the time. They would also go on to fight in the Second World War. Let's hope that's not the case for the German actors in the latest incarnation of All Quiet on the Western Front, which can, if you are completely averse to watching it with subtitles, you can always actually have the English language version as well, because it is on Netflix, so you do have that choice. Although I would certainly recommend, if possible, watch it in the original German. It does make sense from that point of view. Sarah Huntley, difficult times, this. Difficult times that we're experiencing globally, and a movie for our times, perhaps, and a movie that actually clearly has a message, as Richard has said, very much relating to the war machine. Great times currently for arms manufacturers and weapons dealers, because they are continually churning stuff out. I don't think we're recycling the soldiers' uniforms as yet, but I'm sure it's a matter of time with sustainability. Sarah, any thoughts on yourself?
Well, it's terribly poignant to talk about it today. I think... Well, I really think what Cathy said was very good. And I think that probably it's quite a good thing that Netflix have done it, because what it will do is make a younger generation perhaps watch the story that might not have gone back to the original one. For me, I think the poignancy is that, yes, you know, you talk about the war machine and everything that's happening, and the film Dunkirk, I thought, was fantastic, because it showed it, if you were looking at it as a, how you tackled it. But within war, there's people's lives, aren't there? And so Richard saying at the beginning of that about recycling the uniforms just off dead people. It's just horrific. So for me, I suppose I'm very humbled, as I always am, by everybody that's done what they can and isn't here and lost their lives shortly and did what they could. I don't understand, whatever religion you are, why are you... No, the Germans didn't want to fight, the English didn't want to fight the ridiculousness of war and what everyone's doing, and of course at the moment with Ukraine. But I think maybe these movies would be very good for other people, because for me, the most crippling things that you, when you think, God, I'm having a bad day, it's nothing in comparison. I mean, I've just been working with some people doing the story about the truce on Christmas Day, and I mean, obviously that's sentimentalized and everything, but we were talking about how big No Man's Land was. We were talking about trying to get the feeling to act it. Just what is quite incredible is when we're all a bit unwell and not feeling great, how did people actually survive in the trenches? I don't know. I mean, their socks were ingrowing into their skin with the dampness. It's quite incredible, without antibiotics, that those men survived. It was sheer willpower on both sides. And perhaps what the Netflix one will do, and I will watch it. I mean, one of the films that affected me very badly was the Boy in Striped Pyjamas, because I know that was a different war, but I've never got that film out of my head. It's just horrible. But I think if this film does the thing about the uniforms and sometimes very small things, that's why I think when you visit places like Amsterdam and you go to, I'm not saying this from the Jewish point of view now, but you go to a memorial, the most striking one is something like a heap of glasses that were just taken and shoes. You don't need to put a plaque or anything there. That's people. And so maybe this film, what Richard said, will remind us constantly of actually the fact we're sitting in a warm room and are alive and have food and, you know, something to look forward to tomorrow, how lucky we are. So yes, and I think it's terribly important. And in a way, I think the fact that they do get remade is probably good, because I think it's handing it on, and then those people will look back and go back to the original films. But yeah, how poignant for today, but there, for always, not just for today.
There is, of course, the desensitization aspect. I mean, there's one place where a cat is killed, and is killed, in fact, by a child, effectively, and he's lifted back to the main doctor, and basically the doctor effectively just ignores it. He's clearly become so desensitized to the death that we've actually got that we just see this happening as a matter of course. It certainly is, so I think, at least for a limited time, got people thinking about should they see war as entertainment, and whether games such as Call of Duty are indeed appropriate, where effectively the actuality of war is something far, far worse. I would give this a 9 out of 10. In terms of the original line, I think it was very well put together, very well structured. There are lots of moments that are relating. Richard started off by the foxhole. Of course, the foxes and soldiers in a foxhole looking for some sort of solace in amongst the rats, in amongst the sort of food challenges that they've got, all of the sort of issues that are actually there. Richard, again, it seems a little bit unusual to give a score for this, but nevertheless, we will actually quantify it. What's your number?
Well, I mean, given the circumstances, I would say one thing. Just on hearing what everyone says is very, very interesting. And I mean, and also the relevance of it, and especially now with the horrors of Ukraine, I think very often old films, simply because, I mean, it's rather like comparing The Longest Day, which was a great hit in the 1960s about D-Day, with Saving Private Ryan, also about D-Day and on Omaha Beach, the American experience. The one, because of CGI, because of changed techniques of showing the visceral horror of war, is much more, or would seem much more to probably to most people or most viewers, because it is
handled in a way that's different. I mean, old films very often do date. It's not a question so much of their message, it's a question of the way they were made and the time that they were filmed. So from this point of view, I would give it 10 out of 10. I thought the performances were excellent, and it is so terrifying that you find it almost impossible to believe that people could survive in any sense in these mud-filled hell holes and in the way that they seem to. I thought it was superb. Yes, it's interesting that, of course, the Germans have the German side. I mean, that, of course, was what the original showed too. Yes, very, very powerful. I don't think it could have been better done.
And also particularly worrying that Russia have now decided to actually include or reinstitute military training for all their schools as well. So clearly they're learning the operations very effectively, because in both cases, it's the young people who are actually at school who are effectively brainwashed to actually go and fight for their country and effectively see it as a case of glory. And they are seeking to be heroes, where, of course, the ultimate tragedy is that actually in war, there are no heroes. We can leave it there. Kathy.
Well, I was going to say, I think the important thing that everyone has kind of said at one point is that there's been like one image, one idea, one thing that's come from these films that really sticks with you. You know, when Sarah was bringing up how had to think about the reusing of uniforms, like these are things that aren't really talked about. It's something that is only, you know, you find until you actually allow yourself to learn about it. My big shocking moment was when I was working with humanitarian aid, was finding out what was the most needed thing to be donated, and that was body bags, which is like, you know, and not only that, but not talking about it in the refugee center, because obviously there are Ukrainian refugees suffering from this right now and not being something to bring up. And I think if you take that one thing that reminds you from, and whatever is that aspect, I think everyone has that one idea, knowledge, thought that comes from these films to remind them like how truly awful this is and why we should prevent this. I think the film is successful and is already a success if it can do that.
And on the plus side, it does show that if you are one of the generals and you actually got a nice cabin that you can actually stay in, or a nice train that you actually go up to, obviously you'll have the best of everything from that point of view, because the generals don't necessarily have the same kind of scenarios as the cannon fodder or indeed the infantry troops. Okay, we've had one foreign language movie. Yes, Natasha.
If I might just add into that, just it's a really interesting, if you're interested more in like the sort of philosophy behind the war and the discussions about it, Stephen Fry actually does a really beautiful rendition talking about this in his book about Troy. It's really beautiful in the end, and talking about, you know, sort of the philosophy and some of the stuff that we've discussed today. And I would recommend it to any of the viewers who are interested in this topic and more of the philosophy behind it. Sorry.
or indeed listeners, which is fine. As I said, we've had one foreign language movie. It seems like only yesterday that it was actually Parasites that was winning all the plaudits as far as the Academy Awards was actually concerned. This is also from South Korea. Its decision to leave slightly more, shall we say, focused text than Parasite, or maybe not. Richard, your thoughts on Decision to Leave?
Well, Decision to Leave is a very interesting movie. Now, this is also, I would add, we're just looking forward to the Oscars and on the best film lists or best director lists, you're starting to see it. It's billed as a neo-noir romantic mystery film, and that certainly makes it sound very intriguing. Those of us like me who, on the whole, like quite a structure of a film that you can understand, that is quite simple, it is perhaps a little less appealing. But it's a film about obsession. It won Best Director for Park Chan-wook at Cannes, which was very impressive. So we meet Detective Hae-jun, played by Park Ho, and he works in Busan. He rarely sees his wife. His partner is also involved in this case where an immigration worker is found dead at the foot of a mountain which he tended to climb. And the focus is very much on this worker's younger, much younger, wife, played Seo Ray, played by Tang Wei. She's a carer, so she works with people with dementia. And also she initially is a suspect. And Hey John watches her at night. He's an insomniac, which makes him an intriguing and rather curious character, I have to say. And she discovers this. And she admits also she'd killed her mother, as she'd been asked to do so, as her mother had been terminally ill. And they're beginning to think that it's perhaps suicide, that this worker fell down the mountain or whatever. But then various other things come to light, and Hey John decides that this is something that definitely needs very close investigation. The point being, of course, that when you're dealing with the elderly can give you alibis, but it can be also the case that they don't know what day it is, and so forth. Cut to the next section of the film, we actually see a relationship developing between Hagen and Seo Wei, Ray. The problem with this is he becomes fascinated by her, and he also starts becoming obsessed by her when he and his wife, he's moved to be with her, but he's, again, his insomnia is bad, he's depressed, he's still a detective in the force, and they meet Seo Ray with her new husband, Ho Chi, played by Paul Yang-woo. The next day, he is found dead in the swimming pool.
There's a pattern emerging here, Richard, I can see.
There is indeed, and very clearly you... There's this predicament but with this detective who is undoubtedly curious as to why this has happened twice. And the way this progresses, no spoilers, Alex, I would point out, is, I can only say, macabre. It reminded me of a Japanese film called Woman of the Dunes, which I saw many years ago. There were echoes of that. The performances are excellent. Visually, it's very rich. I would point out somehow that in some cases, when the detective fantasizes, you can see the fantasy together with the reality of what's there on the screen, which does make it occasionally confusing. The narrative structure is what tended to be quite awkward, I found anyway, in a movie, but it's very skillfully produced. It's a quintessential art house film in many ways. And will it be as successful as Parasite? No, at least I don't think so. Is it well made?
Will it be as successful as The Handmaiden, Richard? Because that's also been produced and directed by Park Chan-wook.
Yes, indeed it was. And I thought The Handmaiden was a very superior piece of work. It was wonderfully macabre. Did you see it?
It was a very interesting aspect, and particularly given that Park Chan-wook was actually born in 1963, he shares his date of arrival on the planet with at least one of our contributors in the programme today.
Really, Alex, who could that be?
Oh, God.
I think it might be me.
Oh. Progressing onwards. So overall, your score then for this particular Park Chan-wook scenario, Decision to Leave?
Well, I mean, it is a very intriguing, very well filmed, not entirely satisfying as I saw it, but nonetheless, it's also been very highly regarded. I would give it 7, definitely. I thought it was very good. It's a very, very intriguing film. It did occasionally confuse me.
Natasha, is it one for you, or is it a case of I'm still recovering from Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris?
No, I think that it definitely sounds very interesting. I don't mind an artsy movie when I feel like there's substance behind it. This one seems like it's juicy and the plot is interesting. Yeah, so it's definitely something that I feel like I'd like to see. I feel like it's an interesting sort of what they've gone with the obsession, because it is... we've seen emerging out of, you know, the whole hoo-ha around the last Tokyo Olympics, etc., with all the problems that they are having in South Korea with, you know, the treatment of women and the attitudes towards women and all the...
They've got one or two problems with their neighbours in the north as well.
Yeah, oh, definitely. But it's definitely, I think, in terms of sort of treatment of women, it's not particularly ranking very well in the world right now. So it's interesting to see this sort of movie coming out of that and how it's handled, and it'll be interesting to see the sort of reaction to it. So yeah, I would like to see it. If Richard finds it confusing, I might definitely be struggling, but I'll definitely give it a go to understand all of it.
Kathy, decision to leave. Will you have a decision to watch?
I'm interested in watching it, but I'm sad to say that I think today's theme is, I think things would be a lot better if everyone had a little bit of therapy. a little bit of therapy didn't hurt anybody. a lot of these situations. But yeah, I'm curious. I want to see something new. Why not? Let's do it.
And Sarah, what about yourself? I'm not sure how fond you are of the South Korean cinematic experience.
Well, it's not a first go-to, I have to say. And the fact that Richard finds it a bit confusing, I agree with Natasha, that probably completely go over my head. Sometimes, if I'm in the mood, it's very interesting to engage with a culture that is so incredibly different to your own. But at the moment, I'm feeling a bit needy for sort of warmth and comforting things. So I have to be honest, probably not at the moment. Probably more when I'm in one of my intellectual modes.
Sarah, it's just as well we started off the whole programme today with that purveyor of warmth, Anthea Turner. So she sends her best all from that point of view. So there we are. It all slots into place, as you'll hear in the full product. Natasha, Black Adam has gone off the box office radar now. It's vanished. It's been kicked off, apparently, by a movie you've recently caught up with from, of course, the wonderful world of animation. So Richard probably will never, ever see it. But what are your thoughts on this particular one that you've been going to see?
Yes, I doubt anyone will probably be here today will probably be watching it.
It's Studio Ghibli.
No, it's a One Piece movie. So it's linked to the One Piece franchise. Obviously, one of the, well, I think it is the longest running anime currently.
I just told you there, Natasha, because I have to say, I'm not sure whether Sarah, Kathy, or Richard, and I have to include myself, are familiar with the term One Piece franchise.
Yes. So One Piece is a long-running animation series in Japan. It launched back in the late 90s. There's now currently over 1,000 episodes released. And if you are a diehard fan, you will have, like myself, obviously that's a lot of years of watching. So the latest franchise, so what tends to happen with anime movies, as I explained, they generally tend to be sort of non-canon to the timeline. So you sort of have the main series, and then the sort of additional movies are sort of nice little snippets, but they don't really link to the main action that's happening actually in the series. What's nice about this film, which is entitled Red, it's actually been written by Oda, who is the writer of the main series. And it's nice to see some of the threads coming together that may actually be a bit more canon. If you are a massive fan of the series, there are big spoilers in this for what's coming up. Certain fifth element revealed, that's probably the reason why it's knocked everybody off the top spot, because I think Kathy knows what I'm referring to, but I won't give any more spoilers. It's also the 10th highest grossing Japanese film of all time, so it's done very well in the cinemas internationally. As I say, on Friday it did knock Black Adam off the top spot. It grossed 4.8 million. It's got a big following, this one, I think, yeah, because of the spoiler that I potentially mentioned and the excitement around it. Give you a little bit of a teaser of the plot. So it's based all around a music concert. The opening premise is the Straw Hats have gone to see a music concert by a young woman called Uta. And she somehow ends up being connected with Luffy. And whether or not she may or may not be sort of related to a certain pirate from both of their past is, I think that's not a spoiler. I think everyone kind of knows where this is going with this. And unfortunately, it's not the nice concert that everyone thinks it is, and it actually takes a bit of a dark twist. And interesting theme linked, I suppose, to today's show is that it does look a bit at war and peace, and sort of looks a little bit about, you know, the lengths that people will go to try and maintain peace, and whether or not, you know, whether or not if we take away free will, well, you know, do people have free will? Do we take away war? What sort of links to that? It's quite an interesting, there's some heavy themes in there, which is, you know, typical Oda, it's typical One Piece. It's a great movie. The soundtrack is banging. I would give it a solid 9. I had a really great experience. I think what's keeping it from being a 10 is, I think Kathy will agree with me, there's some really epic moments of the anime that are just like, you just see them and your whole body just sings. I feel like there were some really good moments in this, but it wasn't quite Enies Lobby, if Kathy knows what I'm talking about. It wasn't quite that level, but it was still good. I still very much enjoyed it. And yeah, the nice little spoiler, there was a lot of screams and shouts of joy in the cinema. It was a very joyous experience. And if you are a fan of the series, go for it. If you don't want to be spoiled, maybe leave off. But if you're up to date with the manga, there's nothing here that will be spoiled. So yeah, I would definitely recommend. And I've already downloaded all the soundtrack.
One Piece Red, obviously taking out Black Adam, which is extraordinary, it's extreme. Next week, I suspect, we'll be having another tribute, a eulogy, one might say, to Chadwick Boseman, because I suspect Richard will be into Wakanda Forever. No spoilers, so, but...
Yes, absolutely. I intend to see it tomorrow, yes.
Just to point out, Wakanda is indeed a fictional country. It isn't real. And likewise, vibranium is not a real metal, just in case people are confused in all sorts of ways. But for the moment, to Anthea Turner, Sarah Huntley, Kathy Manso, Natasha Wanton, and Richard Fitzwilliams, huge thanks. And inevitably, keep on watching the movies.